Mr. Montiel, you are appointed by the court to attend. We appreciate your having taken the case.
Thank you, Your Honor. It was an honor to argue before the panel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Carperos.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm here on behalf of Aaron Private Clinic Management. We're seeking to vacate the order of dismissal based on alleged lack of standing. And what I'd like to focus here today on is standing based on an injury in fact. Judge Duffy had ruled that incorrectly that standing requires that a plaintiff establish an injury in fact, which is concrete and particularized, an actual or imminent, a causal connection between the injury and the causal conduct.
It would help me if I'd understand a couple of things. Yes, so there was a licensing moratorium, right?
Correct.
And that licensing moratorium is no longer in effect. Is that
correct.
Right? So any request for injunctive relief about the licensing moratorium is moot, isn't it?
Under the old statute, yes. Now there's just that 30-day open enrollment period. It's a new act, but
right.
There were damages associated with the moratorium in and of itself.
Well, whether there were damages is a separate question, but insofar as injunctive relief is involved, that's moot, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So then the question then really is for everything else in the complaint, the question is whether they're standing or not, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And again, the Aaron Private Clinic was formed, hired a manager, it consulted people to open an opioid addiction center. And again, initially there was the moratorium, now there's this 30-day open enrollment period. But the particularized damages, Judge Duffy seems to be focused on monetary, where the issue is the statute that for whatever reason limits this center to a 30-day license period.
All right, well, let's break this down. So the licensing moratorium, the statute that's no longer in effect, what is alleged here that would allege that moratorium, when it was in effect, caused an actual injury to your client?
He could not obtain a license during the moratorium period, could not pursue the business opportunity.
Don't you have to allege enough to show plausibly that but for that licensing moratorium, your client would have done certain things that would have inevitably benefited him in a way that the licensing moratorium damaged him. I don't see where there's nearly enough in the complaint to allege anything like that about the old licensing moratorium.
Well, I think it's a balance because, again, what's the burden if there's a moratorium, and again, Duffy was seemed focused on damages. How far does a plaintiff in this situation have to go to incur monetary loss? Does it need to enter the lease, knowing that it's not going to be able to get a license, hire employees, knowing it's never really going to be able to employ
I know, but the problem is that you have to allege a lot more than would be basically speculative. I mean, basically what you're recounting there would make any claim for damages, it seems to me, wholly speculative.
But the damages themselves are not necessarily monetary under the protections of the, there are monetary damages, but the damage in this case is the fact that they couldn't even apply for a license originally. They couldn't even apply. There were no applications. So how can you pursue your business opportunity if you're not even provided the opportunity to get the license? This would be analogous as assuming that the state decided to provide a cap on licenses to Greek, driver's licenses to Greek Orthodox people. Well, then you come back and say, I'm Greek Orthodox, by the way, and then it's even modified to the one-month period.
Right.
Well, Ms. Carper, yeah, you didn't even try to buy a car. If you didn't even buy a car,
yeah.
Why are you concerned about this?
Yeah, well, you might be able, though, to say, and because of that, I missed work, you know, 3 days a week, or I had to pay my friend to give me a ride, or I had to, you know, I had to use Uber. It was more expensive. There are things you could allege that could, I'm not saying that your hypothetical claim for relief is necessarily a meritorious one, but there's a lot more you could allege about even that hypothetical claim for relief that would be even less speculative about damages than what we have here.
In the Todd case, kind of an analogous scenario was they cited another case in it, and it had to do with, this was on, I'm sorry, I don't have the page number, but it talks about accommodations at a courthouse, that the wheelchair ramps and bathrooms at the courthouse impeded their ability to attend the trials at the courthouse. This is 256 F3rd at 1080. And it says, although both plaintiffs attended the trial at the courthouse, the 11th Circuit found that they adequately stated a claim under Title II of the ADA. The court stated, if the courthouse's wheelchair ramps are so steep that they impede a disabled person, or if its bathrooms are unfit for the use of a disabled person, then it cannot be said that the trial is readily accessible, regardless of whether the disabled person manages in some fashion to attend the trial. And again, they didn't say they didn't have standing. What were your damages? You're complaining about this.
Yeah, we're not talking about anything like that. I mean, if we're talking about a disabled person who is suing about a lack of accommodations under Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act, that's wholly different from someone who wants to operate some kind of business, in this case, a methadone clinic. And you're alleged, you have to first establish, you have to allege enough to establish that you have Article III standing, that you have either suffered or will suffer an actual imminent injury, that it is fairly traceable to the defendant, and that the court can provide meaningful relief. Those are requirements of Article III, constitutional standing. It seems that the claim for injunctive relief about the old moratorium is moot, and that the rest of it you just haven't alleged enough to establish Article III standing.
I disagree in that the statute itself discriminates against a group of people that the plaintiff is trying to help. And that statute.
Yeah, but the injury has to be to your client. It's not about them.
Well, the okay? Injury is if he wants to go apply for that license today, he can't. Open enrollment is from December 1st to December 31st. And he can only apply during 1 month a year, whereas if it was any other facility.
What injury was caused to your client's operation?
It wasn't in operation.
In operation. I understand. What injury? Well, some of them, there was no injury.
That's not true. He had formed the corporation. He was seeking investors. He hired a manager. It's in the pleadings. And again, it gets into mitigation of damages. Is this court trying to say, oh, you didn't go far enough along?
You have more injury alleged in your brief than you have in the complaint in this case.
Well, we cited to the complaint.
The brief has some things that aren't in the complaint.
The amended complaint?
The amended complaint.
All right. I thought we had cited to the paragraphs in the amended complaint.
The district court, we have to make, the district court makes its decision on what's in the amended complaint.
And it had
that's
both
all
before
we review.
It,
yeah. Whatever, if there's more added in the brief before us, it doesn't matter. We're reviewing the district court's evaluation of the amended complaint.
And again, I believe that, again, it gets to a point of, you know, how far does the court, the state, expect someone to go? And there are other cases, you know, that simply being denied the opportunity to apply is a violation of the ADA.
What's your best case, would you say, supports your position? Can you cite, what's the best case you cite you think is most analogous to the situation here?
I believe it's MX Energy. There's a case called Start Inc. versus Baltimore. It's a Maryland case, 295 F Sup 569, that a startup for-profit corporate plaintiff having only plans and never identifying any prospective patients had standing to sue under the ADA. And they were citing MX Group at 293 F 3rd at 336.
And what court is that out of?
Maryland.
Maryland.
295 F Sup. Second, 569.
Yeah, but those were plaintiffs that, who had gone through the application for a permit, were turned down. Your client hadn't even really found a location, right?
I don't know if it was specifically
the address listed for the clinic was the address of the law office of plaintiff's counsel.
That was the business address for the plaintiff, correct.
That doesn't suggest that they'd actually found a suitable clinic location or engaged in any kind of site selection process.
But again, it begs the question, if you find the site, which again, it's not on the record, but you know, if you had the site, which he did, but you can't do anything because of licensing moratorium, how do you reconcile that? If you go ahead and sign a lease and then this is tied up for 2 years and you're obligated for lease payments, then we're going to have damages because he's now out of pocket. How far does the plaintiff have to go to address this rule that discriminates under the ADA?
You saved some rebuttal time.
Yes, I did. Thank you.
Mr. Chalmers.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Roger Chalmers with the Georgia Law Department for Commissioner Barry and Governor Nathan Deal. The District Court did not err in finding that the management company that is the plaintiff in this case, and we can ask what's in a name, we have a management company. We don't even have a clinic. The District Court did not err in finding that the management company failed to plead flat facts showing that it has standing to pursue its claims. This is what the complaint alleged, and I'd like to correct a few things that counsel indicated at the beginning of the argument. One, that the company had hired a manager. There's no pleading to that effect. The other, that the company had consulted people to open this clinic. There's no facts pled to that effect. And Your Honors, through your question, asked there and suggested, and I think correctly so, as the District Court found, there has to be something in the complaint suggesting a but-for causation, something suggesting more than speculation, something suggesting that there was harm to the operation of a business here. And that is not so. If you look to the complaint, it says, Aaron Private Clinic Management Company intends to meet the standards to establish a narcotic treatment program. It will offer standard of care treatment to prospective patients. That's it. That's literally all that is pleaded. Then when you get to the counts, it says it's been harmed by these laws that are being challenged in this case. And it says the harm is economic injury, including damage caused by interference and delays with things such as planning, raising investment funds, hiring, and other normal processes.
It had alleged that we hired somebody, we had incurred costs for site selection, all of which basically were wasted by the efforts, you know, by what the defendants had done. That would probably get them across the line for constitutional standing, wouldn't it?
I think you're right, Your Honor. That would get them certainly closer. That would get them to that point where they could say they have an injury in fact, they have one component.
Whether it's cognizable as a claim, you know, as a matter of the statute and all that is a different matter. But
that's
but
right.
From the standpoint of alleging enough to state that they have suffered an actual injury, that would probably probably do it, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. And I think if you look at...
Then they run into the problem of whether they're statutory standing.
Then you run into the problem, which counsel did not address, as to whether or not there is an associational discrimination claim. But again, with respect to that 2016 law, of course, any claim for injunctive relief is moot. And so they would have to show by plausible and non-conclusory allegations that there was harm to the plaintiff from the challenged law. That 2016 law did place a temporary moratorium on new license applications, but it allowed then pending applications to move forward. And the complaint allegations that I just read did not show how this company has been harmed by that law. There's no allegation, for example, that when the 2016 law was passed, it had submitted an application already that was not processed. There's no allegation that it was prepared to submit an application. There's no allegation it was a business in operation or with patients when the 2016 law was passed, which was somehow affected by the law.
There's a Third Circuit 2007 case called New Directions Treatment Services versus City of Reading. Are you familiar with that case?
I'm familiar with the cases from the other circuits.
I mean, the court held, and I quote, the proprietors of a proposed methadone treatment facility have standing to seek relief. I wonder how you would distinguish that case.
I don't recall the facts of New Directions specifically, but I can Judge Gilman, with respect to that, there are a number of cases that were cited in the briefs by the appellant. Addiction Specialist, MX Group, which was mentioned, Innovative Health, and A Helping Hand from other circuits. In every one of those cases, we can see that constitutional standing clearly was established. And so, for example, there were allegations indicating that many of the plaintiffs in those cases were already operating clinics. Others had formed or incorporated the clinic that would actually be providing the service. Here, we just have a management company. Many of them had located sites for their treatment programs, had worked with realtors or zoning officials, had entered into leases, had paid rent on leases. And many of the cases, the plaintiffs had submitted zoning applications. And so it's not correct to say that it's simply futile to do anything at all to start up the business.
You are required to get a license, obviously, in Georgia to open up one of these clinics. If they're alleging that the burdens of that licensing law is discriminatory, why is that not enough to give them standing? I mean, there are all sorts of problems with the summary judgment and other things, you know, down the road, but we're talking about just not having standing. What's your best case to say that someone who wants to apply, and is facing a licensing requirement they claim is onerous, doesn't have standing? What's your best case for that?
I think the best case, and they are old cases, they're the Worth v. Selden case and the Lujan case. And Worth says that in order to get over the constitutional minimum requirements of standing, you've got to have specific, concrete facts showing harm. And then Lujan said, with respect to some of the plaintiffs in that case, that it's not enough simply to say, well, I intend to do something in the future. In that case, it was, I intend to go to a place where endangered species may not exist if certain things don't happen. That's what we have here. We have a plaintiff saying, I intend to open up a clinic in the future. So Judge Gilman, to your point, if that clinic had been established, if it had taken any steps to show that it was imminent, that it actually was going to go forward, well, then maybe there would be standing. But failing to show that, simply saying I intend to without pleading facts showing that that's imminent, that that actually is going to happen sometime soon, you haven't differentiated yourself from the class of citizens as a whole to which the statute applies. You're just bringing a general...
It's not just that it will happen, pleading enough to show that it will happen, but pleading enough to also show that whatever it is that's going to happen is actually going to injure the plaintiff.
That's correct. So that's that last part of the three-part standing test, redressability, is also speculative if you haven't set up the initial part showing that you've actually been harmed by the action that you're challenging. With respect to the 2017 law, there also is no allegation. Now, this is the law that's currently in effect. There's no allegation that this plaintiff has submitted an application or did submit an application that was denied based on arbitrary or discriminatory requirements. No allegation it will be prevented from participating in open enrollment. No allegations that flesh out in any plausible way that if it did participate in open enrollment, its application would be denied. And as the district court says, the labels arbitrary and discriminatory that are given in the complaint to this latest law do not help with the standing analysis. The complaint does not identify any specific licensing requirement with which this plaintiff cannot comply. It does not allege how or show why any requirement is discriminatory, and it doesn't allege or show how any requirement prevents it from establishing a clinic in the future. Without these requirements, we're left with a generalized grievance. We're left with something that the courts have said over and over cannot be adjudicated because you have not met even the bare minimum to get your case into a federal court. Your Honors, I know that associational discrimination under Title II was not addressed in counsel's argument, and likewise, third-party standing or associational standing
we probably
were not
really
addressed.
Shouldn't address that, should we? I mean, if constitutional standing hasn't been satisfied here,
I agree.
Not enough allegations in the complaint, then it's not justiciable. We lack subject matter jurisdiction to entertain the complaint, and or the district court does, and we shouldn't really get into the. Into the associational standing claim, right?
That is correct.
Because that would be evaluating the merits of the case in an instance where we don't have jurisdiction. We could do it, I guess, as an alternative ground, but because the first ground is really jurisdictional, your argument would be we shouldn't do that, right?
Yes, it would be, Your Honor. Constitutional, the minimum requirements of standing govern here.
Well, if we did get into the merits, you'd have a tougher case, wouldn't you? I have a note that at least five circuits have held that methadone clinics can bring claims under Title II resulting from their association with disabled persons.
Well, in every one of the cases, Your Honor, however, there was no dispute that the constitutional minimum requirements of standing had been met.
Oh, that's what I'm saying, but I'm saying if we got beyond the standing, you would.
Yeah, I think the other difficulty with those cases, though, is there has not been one entered after the Lexmark decision in 2014.
Yeah.
And I think that's key. I think if you look at those cases, they don't do a full statutory analysis, which Lexmark now makes clear you must do. Lexmark broke a standing inquiry into two pieces, if you'll recall. It talked about zone of interest and proximate cause. And I think it really focused in on what is the statutory cause of action. Here, we have a for-profit company seeking money damages under the Americans with Disabilities Act Title II. It's an associational discrimination kind of claim, but the Congress did not expressly allow that kind of claim.
Yeah.
So I think that would be the difference between those cases that came before Lexmark and this one.
Well, the other problem, isn't it, with all those cases is that they rely extensively on legislative history as opposed to what the statute actually says. It appears to me that at least Title II and Titles I and III are very different in terms of whether they expressly provide for
the right
of action. And
It
may well be that those circuits are wrong because they base basically everything in their analysis on legislative history.
That is correct, Your Honor, and you don't, of course, get to legislative history where the statute is clear. Here it's patently clear because you have Title II, which is sandwiched right in between Titles I and III, which expressly allow associational discrimination claims, and Title II does not. There's precedent clearly saying that when that is the case, congressional intent is derived from those words of the statute.
I mean, you've got Title I and III, they're clear about whether there's an associational claim. And then you have that kind of language is entirely omitted from Title II, which would suggest that Congress consciously chose not to create that kind of claim for Title II.
The suggestion is very clear, Your Honor. I'd agree on that. If there are no further questions, I'll cede the time. Thank you.
We have the case.
Thank you.
Your Your Honor, again, it gets back to the issue of damages, which seems to be the big hang-up. And on page 17 of our brief, where we actually cited the New Directions case, it's also an 11th Circuit case, a Carver Middle School Gay Straight Alliance versus School Board of Lake County, where the 11th Circuit ruled that nominal damages are appropriate in cases of statutory violations. And in this case, again, there's not huge monetary damages because that's balanced with mitigation of damages. How far do you have to go in hiring people, do site plans, when you're absolutely barred from even applying for a license? So we're talking about minimal standing about, you know, you had to have a license and be rejected maybe, but in this case, you couldn't even get the license. And part of what's being challenged in the injunction is the license criteria, getting into the merits of it, but also that it's only for 1 month of year. That's also what the damages are, seeking injunctive relief so that these licenses can be applied for year round. I'm trying to think. But for the moratorium, that's clearly pleaded, they would have applied for the license. That was their intent. That's why this appeal has been filed. You know, the expenses is the plaintiff wants to pursue this clinic, and it can't, and it filed this lawsuit. So to say that it's not serious, it hadn't taken enough steps, it clearly has. We wouldn't be here today if the plaintiff wasn't serious about operating a methadone treatment center. So that's all I have to say on those issues. And I think we cite one more thing in the case is, you know, plaintiff isn't required under this scenario to take futile actions. And futile actions would be pursuing and incurring expenses when it can't obtain the license because the statute itself is discriminatory. That's all I have.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Nope. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go to the last case. Northeastern.